and my wife and I are very different. We don't think the same, see the same, act the same, do pretty much anything the same, which is what makes it such an interesting dynamic in our home. When you experience Brooke and I, as we are telling stories, you will experience this at a high level. See, Brooke and I tell stories very differently. I tell stories a lot because I love telling them, and you get to hear many of them from this very stage. And Brooke tells stories too, but for Brooke, they shape up differently than they do for me. Why? When I tell a story, which I love doing, the story to me is about the key point, right? I try to discover what it is that matters in the story. I bring that point out, and the details of that story become completely irrelevant to me. I mean, if the details shift and shape a little bit because I didn't remember exactly how they played out, whatever, you know? And in fact, for the most part, if I skip over details or I don't add details in that still communicate the point of the story, hey, works for me. I work on a clock. I got things to do. I got to get through it. Brooke, on the other hand, every detail matters to her. I mean, every detail. To the point that for the first few years of me preaching, we would drive home many times and she would say, "How do you feel about lying to the congregation?" Now, she didn't quite say it that way, but she's like, you told them a story. It didn't happen that way. And I'm like, it did happen that way. Well, no, that happened and this happened. I'm like, those are details. They don't matter. And she goes, they matter. Truth is truth and it matters. And you know, I'm like, okay. So you experience the story best when you hear Brooke tell it, and then you hear me tell it, and then you go, got it. I got all the details, and I've captured the essence of the story. Because with Brooke, you may get lost in some of the details, and with me, you may miss out on some important things while we're trying to stay in focus. When you experience the Gospels, you have to understand from the get-go that you are reading a single unit, Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, not four different units, because each of them are bringing a layer into the story that matters. Otherwise, God wouldn't have put it there. God did not have those boys write differently and tell things with slight different details in different order because he thought it wouldn't be neat to confuse the population and think that he doesn't exist. He did that because it creates layers for us to understand the full picture. These guys did not see the stories differently. They just communicated them differently in terms of the details and essence they put in, because Matthew is writing to a very particular audience that Luke is not. Luke's writing to a centurion called Theophilus, and Matthew's writing to a Jewish group of people that need to listen into the Jewish history. They are different personalities. They see things differently in terms of the way they communicate story, and they've ordered their stories differently to make certain points. So when you read, you have to read all of them simultaneously. The reason I say that is because we've spent a great deal of time in the book of Matthew for the last few months because we've been sitting on the side of a mountain listening to the Sermon on the Mount. And I chose intentionally to stay in Matthew because though Luke deals with it and Mark deals with it as well, it is such a complex piece of art as Jesus preaches this message that if we tried to, on top of that, see the nuances between the three, you guys would be so confused you wouldn't know what to do with yourself and you'd miss the point. But when we're stepping into stories, as Jesus is walking through, it is important for us to jump a little bit from gospel to gospel to travel chronologically through the story and see what Jesus is trying to communicate. Today, we will do some of that because we need to. So as we step into the story, let me just set the pace for you or the tone for you so that you understand where we're at, so that you remember where we're coming from, right? We have been sitting on the side of the mountain listening to Jesus preach an incredible message. He has preached with such authority and such power, with such content and wonder, that we are all sitting on the side of this mountain just going, who is this guy? Who is this guy? I mean, you'll hear it in the voices of the crowd that were there. You're hearing it in us. This is unbelievable stuff. This is taught like no one has ever taught on the planet. There's something special about this man. We are going to walk off this mountain now. We're going to follow Jesus, and he's going to go from words of authority to acts of authority, and you're going to see it happen. Because remember this, if you forget this, you forget the point of the Gospels. Jesus Christ, from the time we meet him in the Gospels as an infant, as God is unfolding the story, to when we bump into him at 12 years old, to when we bump into him again at 30, and we watch him go through the baptism, the temptation, Nazareth, and all the other things he does, Jesus is intentionally declaring a single thing over and over and over again. I am the promised Messiah. I am the God of the universe. When I bump into people and they say to me, you know, I don't know that Jesus ever said he was the only way or Jesus ever said he was God. I go, what part of the Gospels did you miss? It wasn't that he said it two or three times. He started saying it the second he hit this planet and he didn't stop, hasn't stopped and won't stop through the rest of the Gospels. So Jesus is declaring to us his authority. He is declaring to us his power. He is declaring to us the fact that he is Messiah so that we will place our trust in him as Messiah, sell our souls to him, follow him to the T with everything he commands and live a life of freedom. That's what Jesus is up to. And we're going to watch him do it right here, right now in some extraordinary ways. So grab your Bibles and let's turn to the book of Matthew together. Under the seats is a bunch of Bibles if you don't have one of your own here. And in our Bibles that are under the seats, we're going to go to Matthew chapter 8, page 674, or your Bibles, Matthew chapter 8. By the way, keep one of ours if you don't have a good Bible at home. We'd love for you to have it. Okay, Matthew chapter 8, page 674. Let's just step back to chapter 7 for a second and read those last few words, verse 28. When Jesus had finished saying these things, the crowds were amazed at his teaching because he taught as one who had authority and not as their teachers of the law. There it is. That wraps up the Sermon on the Mount. Jesus teaches with authority and power. Verse 1 of chapter 8. When he came down from the mountainside, large crowds followed him. A man said, Lord, if you are willing, I'm sorry, a man with leprosy came and knelt before him and said, Lord, if you are willing, you can make me clean. Jesus reached out his hand and touched the man. I am willing, he said, be clean. Immediately he was cured of his leprosy. Then Jesus said to him, see that you don't tell anyone, but go show yourself to the priest and offer the gift Moses commanded as a testimony to them. Okay, so let's start with this story. We're following Jesus as the crowd. He comes down the mountainside. He's on his way to Capernaum. Capernaum is where Jesus lives. This is his town where he has made his residence at this point. Peter lives there also. Several of the disciples are from Capernaum. He's just gone up on the mountain and preached this message, and he's coming home, heading over to Peter's house, actually, on this particular occasion. And on his way down the mountain, he bumps into this incredible and weird man. Why weird and incredible? Because this circumstance is very odd, all right? Jesus is being followed by a crowd. When we think of Jesus being followed by a crowd, we often think of this guy with these hordes around him and he's walking everywhere he goes. The big crowd follows him, but that's not what it would have looked like. A crowd following Jesus would have been one of those things where you just sort of hang out near him, all right? Because you never know what he's going to do. You never know, and you don't bother him while he's having lunch. I mean, it's like when you see a famous person, you know, at a restaurant in New York, and so suddenly there's a crowd following them, but not really. You know what I mean? It's like we're all sort of just wonder what he's going to do next. You don't want to bother them because you don't want to seem like one of those pathetic people that want to get an autograph really quickly. But at the same time, you want to bother them because they're famous, you know? And this is how this crowd functions. They're just sort of walking with Jesus. Jesus just got up, headed down the mountain. They're all sort of collecting their stuff. And there's a man in the crowd that shouldn't be in the crowd because he is a leper. Lepers should not be in a crowd like this, guys. This is very strange. Leprosy was a disease in the Old Testament and during the time of Christ that was greatly feared. It was extremely dangerous, extremely contagious. And when somebody found themselves having leprosy, they were immediately separated from society, deemed unclean by the Jewish leadership, and put into a leper colony. A leper could not get back into Jewish society or any society for that matter during this time unless they were deemed clean. And the only time that happened is when certain things in their leprosy disappeared and they went through a certain ceremonial act, brought certain offerings that Moses commanded in Leviticus to the priests. The priests determined them as clean. They were baptized into right relationship again, and they were released into everyday society. On occasion, lepers' immune systems would beat the beginning of the disease, and they would actually be a leper that was healed. Or, more often, oftentimes in that day, any skin rash was marked as leprosy. You're sent out to a leper colony, and then 4 days later, your skin rash is gone, and you come back, and it turns out you had leprosy and you were healed, right? So it wasn't very uncommon for a leper to come back to a priest and say, I've been healed. This leper, though, finds himself in the crowd, and he's watching and he's waiting for Jesus to be alone for a minute where there's enough room where he can come and ask something. Because if this leper, there was a big crowd around Jesus, if he came and knelt before Jesus and went, "I'm a leper," that crowd would have run for their lives. I mean, I can guarantee you that. So this happens in that moment where Jesus is just far enough. The leper kneels down and says, "Lord, I am a leper, and I know that if you are willing, I will be clean." What an incredible statement to make by this man. My guess is, and this is just my guess, that this particular leper had leprosy on parts of his body that weren't as visible as some, like the face and stuff, because he made his way into this crowd. He knew he shouldn't have been there, but he was at a point where he was like, I've got to have a word with the master. See, this leper knew something about Jesus, and he declared it. "I don't know if you're going to heal me or not. I don't know if you're going to take my leprosy away or not. But I do know this, from what I've seen and heard, if you want it, it'll be done. That's all I know. I don't know what's going to happen, I just know you can do it. That's all I know. And I know that the only reason you wouldn't do it is if you were, for some reason, unwilling, which I will accept. I just want you to know, I know that if you're willing, I will be clean." He was not asking a question, he was making a statement. And Jesus looks at this man, and without question, he simply says, "I am willing," which is a very interesting statement for Jesus to make, because if I were Jesus, I might have gone, no, I have compassion on you, I love you, it's not good, nothing work." Jesus declares that what he just said was true. He says, "You're right, and I am willing. So, you are clean." And then he says to him, "Don't want you to say anything about this right now. Just go and do what the other lepers do when they're clean." This would not have been unusual. And you see, by doing that, he wouldn't have gone to the temple and the priest wouldn't have gone, "You're the first leper in history that's ever been clean." No, it would have been like, "Another one looks clean. Yep. Okay. Do you have the gift from Moses? Yes. Great. You're clean. Well done." It would have been a pretty normal deal. So Jesus says, just go back and deal with this normally for now. We'll find out later why Jesus is doing that, because it comes up again later on. So he's done with the leper and the leper's off to go and declare himself clean. And this happens. Verse 5, when Jesus had entered Capernaum, so he's come off the mountain now, a centurion came to him asking for help. "Lord," he said, "my servant lies at home paralyzed in terrible suffering." Jesus said to him, "I will go and heal him." The centurion replied, "Lord, I do not deserve to have you come under my roof, but just say the word and my servant will be healed. For I myself am a man under authority with soldiers under me. I tell this one, go, and he goes. I tell that one, come, and he comes. I say to my servant, do this, and he does it." That's what Jesus hears from the centurion. Okay, so let's just talk for a second here. Centurion. A centurion is a Roman military officer. He is in command over 100 Roman military soldiers, hence the term centurion. A centurion is the commander of 100 soldiers. And a centurion was often sent to a town like Capernaum with his 100 soldiers, and he would be the police force for the Roman government in that town. So the centurion would usually have a house in the center of town. In this case, based on archaeology in Capernaum, the centurion's house was right behind the synagogue, and the garrison of 100 soldiers would have existed there. And those 100 soldiers did whatever the centurion needed them to do in an instant to make sure that that town kept the peace under the Roman rule, because the Roman government had the rule over Israel. So this centurion was probably a very important man in town, but also, generally speaking, a very hated man in town, because you're in a Jewish town with the police force over there, and they're Romans, okay? So not a good circumstance to be living. The centurions, though, were men that had proven themselves as leaders and proven themselves as soldiers. These were not people that were afraid of anything. They were not humble, generally speaking, under the way we think of humility, like meek and, "I'm so sorry, I don't deserve." That was not a centurion. A centurion was the guy you do not ever want to meet on the battlefield, because the chances that you will die were very good, because they were very good at what they did. And in the Roman army, things functioned a very particular way, because the Roman army was the most powerful force on the planet at that time in terms of armies, and since. In fact, history will say that the Roman army was probably the most powerful army that ever existed on the face of the planet in terms of its might and its mass, but also its strategy. And if you took the Roman army and made it the same size as any other army we've ever had, the Roman army beats everybody. Why? Because the Roman army functioned the way this guy just described. Every centurion had 100 men, so 10 centurions represented 1,000 men. And when a centurion told their men what to do, there was no questioning it. Do you understand what that means? No questioning it. You didn't blink twice. You didn't think about it. You didn't question it. You didn't say what, where, and how. You just did what you were told to do. No questions asked. Why? Because centurions often sent 100 men into suicide missions. The Roman Empire, when they wanted to take something, it was not a question mark. Their soldiers were going to take it whether they liked it or not. And if you questioned your leader, you questioned the army. And if you questioned the army, the entire Roman system fell apart. So if you questioned your leader, they killed you. It was that simple. You either do what I say or you die. And by the way, if you question what I say, you die. And if you look like you question what I say, you die. Because I can't afford any of that. And that's how they functioned. So here's the centurion, right? And he comes to Jesus and he tells Jesus, this rabbi, hey, my servant is sick in the house. Can you come and heal him? That's what we get from Matthew, but that's not actually what happened. You see, Matthew's doing what I do, ignoring the details and just telling the story. Well, there was the centurion, and he asked Jesus to come to his house and heal him. And when Jesus said, I'll come, the centurion said, don't worry, I'm not worthy, and end of story, and he didn't come. But let's go to Luke because we find out what actually happened in the details. Luke tells us a little more about the story that helps us understand the centurion and understand what Jesus is about to do next. Chapter 7 of the book of Luke, page 716 of our Bibles. Luke has also just written about the Beatitudes and the Sermon on the Mount. He's finished with the wise and foolish builders, just like Matthew. And in verse 1 of chapter 7, it says this, when Jesus had finished saying all this in the hearing of the people, he entered Capernaum. There a centurion's servant, whom the master valued highly, was sick and about to die. Now remember, Luke is writing to a centurion this letter. So Luke's interested in the details here, right? He says this, the centurion heard of Jesus and sent some elders of the Jews to him, asking him to come and heal his servant. Now, that's interesting, isn't it? Because that's different from the other story, isn't it? See, Matthew said the centurion came and asked, but here Luke is saying the centurion sent some Jewish elders to go and ask Jesus. The centurion didn't come at all. Now, in Matthew's defense, when you send servants or representatives to tell you something, in this culture it was not inappropriate at all to say, well, Renaud came and asked Jesus this. Yeah, I mean, he sent elders to do it, but I mean, it was Renaud asking. So it's not like Matthew is being dishonest. It's simply that Luke is adding to choose to put some details that really matter. Watch this. The centurion, so when they came to Jesus, they plead earnestly with him, saying, this man deserves to have you do this because he loves our nation and has built our synagogue. So Jesus went with them. See, here's a couple of interesting points. The centurion understands Jewish culture so well. I mean, you might not just catch it at face value, but it's actually beautiful here, right? So the centurion realizes that there is this man that is walking around that is clearly Lord over the universe, okay? I mean, what he says goes, period. And the centurion recognizes it, and it's a no-brainer for him. It's a lordship thing. Got it. Jesus is king. I understand. So when his servant is sick, he gets together the influence that he has within the Jewish system, the Jewish elders of the town, and says to them, would you go for me to Jesus and ask on my behalf that he would heal my servant? Very interesting that he does this for two reasons. One, that the fact that he had Jewish elders that were his friends were unbelievable, because a Roman centurion would not have had Jewish elders as his friends unless he was truly a compassionate man, compassionate for the Jewish people and understanding their plight. So he goes to these guys and he says, would you do me a favor? And they say, absolutely. They go to Jesus, and outside of his presence, they tell Jesus, this man is awesome. I mean, we love him. We got the best centurion on the planet in our little town, and you ought to do this for him. Not to mention helping a centurion out. You know, you scratch his back, he scratches yours, it works out well. So the Jewish elders are into this, right? Why does the centurion send Jewish elders? Because the centurion understands something about Jesus. Every time Jesus gets to do something, everyone's watching, right? And if a centurion came up to Jesus, met him in public, and had a conversation with him, that would lead to a lot of questions for Jesus. Not so much for the centurion, but definitely for Jesus. Why did he talk to you? What did he want? What did you say? You did that for him? What? Those are our enemies, because everybody thinks Jesus is going to overthrow the government right now, right? So he understands, I don't want to make trouble for Jesus. If I go and talk to him, it's going to get ugly. I'll just send some of my Jewish friends to go and do that. The Jewish friends totally forget themselves. And they say to Jesus, come with us to our centurion friend's house to come and heal his servant. Because they can't think like a centurion thinks about faith. They think they need to take Jesus to see the sick person so he can touch him and heal him. Because healing comes through touching, right? But they forget themselves. Do you know what happens to a Jewish person when they go into a Gentile's house? They are unclean, folks. So if you go into a Gentile's house and you emerge, you got to go through all sorts of crazy ceremonial washing just to get yourself all cleaned up again because you were with a Gentile. Woohoo! Right? So this centurion gets it. He gets the whole culture and he says, I want to make this as easy as possible for Jesus so he doesn't have to answer too many questions and deal with too many junk. So I'm going to send some of my Jewish elders to simply say to him, would you just say, be healed and we'll be done with the story. They forget themselves and they head back with Jesus. So this is what he does. Check this out. Right there in Luke. He was not far from the house, verse 6, when the centurion sent friends to say to him. So now the centurion sees them coming and he goes, oh man, those Jewish boys didn't listen to what I told them. I told them to tell Jesus to heal my servant and not to come here. So he sends his friends out and the friends say, Lord, don't trouble yourself. Now, this wasn't a centurion being all nice and going, I don't want to inconvenience you. This is him saying, I get what's about to happen. Don't get yourself in that kind of trouble. It's not worth it. You're doing a great thing out there. For I do not deserve to have you come under my roof. Again, this is not a false humility. This is a statement of understanding culture. I don't deserve to come and talk with you as far as your culture is concerned, and I certainly don't deserve to have you in my house as a Gentile. I know and understand that. I may not agree with it, and nor may you, but we both understand how the world works, and so I don't deserve to have you in my house, so I don't need to trouble you with coming over here. Watch. That is why I did not consider even coming myself, consider myself worthy to come to you. But say the word, and my servant will be healed. And then he does that same thing. For they are men under my authority, and I say what they want and all that. Okay, so turn back real quick to Matthew chapter 8 again. Matthew chapter 8, we see this happen. Verse 10, page 674, Jesus now responds to the centurion. Okay, and he responds this way. He responds by talking to the crowd. Then when Jesus heard this, he was astonished and said to those following him, I tell you the truth. I have not found anyone in Israel with such great faith. I say to you that many will come from the east and the west and will take their places at the feast with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob in the kingdom of heaven, but the subjects of the kingdom will be thrown outside into the darkness where there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. Then Jesus said to the centurion, or in this case to his friends, go. It will be done just as you believed it would, and his servant was healed that very hour. I don't know that Jesus ever met the centurion, but the centurion became a marker for two incredible things that Jesus shows us. The first thing he shows us is this. And guys, what you're about to hear, I want you to hear loud and clear. Because the only reason you're sitting in this room is because of what just happened. Jesus takes a Gentile Roman centurion and he says to his Jewish followers, that is faith, folks. Pay close attention. That is not only faith, but that is the kind of faith that is going to determine where you end up in the kingdom. Whether you end up in the kingdom of heaven, sitting at Abraham's table with Isaac and Jacob, your forefathers, or whether you're going to end up in the dark kingdom with gnashing of teeth and horrible stuff. And by the way, there will be many like the centurion that will end up at the table, and many of you guys that won't. Wow! I mean, this is like the kind of stuff that diminishes the church in seconds, right? The entire Jewish people leave Jesus and don't want to hear it anymore. You wonder why every now and then it says his teachings were too hard and everyone left. It's because of moments like this where he goes, P.S., I am not just your Messiah. I am everyone's Messiah. And frankly, half of you ain't even going to make it. What? Why? Because you don't get faith, and he does. See, this was an issue of lordship, and this is where Jesus shows us what true faith is, the nature of faith. He says, faith has nothing to do with what you think I'm going to do for you. It has everything to do with who you think I am. You are not placing your faith in what I can do for you. You're placing your faith in who I am for you. And the centurion gets it. He understands who I am. It wasn't so much whether his servant would be healed or not. He simply declared, I get you. You're the master of the universe. Whatever you do goes. Whatever you say goes. Whatever you want goes. So by the way, just thought I'd bring some information to you. My servant is sick. Could you heal him? No, I won't. Great. Fantastic news. Yes, I will. Great. Fantastic news. That's how the military works. You got some information from the field. You carefully and delicately send it up to your commanding officer and say, just in case you were interested that you had missed this information, here it is. But you do with it whatever you want, and I will follow those commands. That is faith, folks. Saying, Jesus, here's the information, just in case you missed it. If you didn't and you have a plan, fantastic. Tell me where to go. And Jesus says, that is faith. This other stuff that you have, not faith. So when we're trying to muster up a belief within ourselves to prove to a God that we're sure he can do what he says he can do so that he'll do it, we do not have faith in God. We have faith in ourselves. We are saying we can muster up enough to convince God to do what he's supposed to. And that is dangerous faith, because it is faith misplaced in the wrong place. And it will either make you so prideful you won't know what to do with yourself, or devastate you so badly you won't know what to do with yourself. And Jesus here says, it doesn't work that way. Some of the most devastated people I've ever met are people that have sat in a room where people have prayed over them. And when they're done praying, they've made this statement, you are healed. As soon as you get enough faith, you'll actually experience it. Wow. I mean, God's done his part. He's healed you. You're set. You just feel horrible and sick still and can't walk still because you don't have enough faith. And those people still can't figure out how to muster up enough. They have more faith in their little finger than most of us will have in a lifetime, and God didn't heal them. I've bumped into stories where someone's grandfather died or someone's dad died, and they will still look me in the eye and say, if I'd only had enough faith, if we'd only had enough faith, I'd still be alive. And I'd go, who are you? Wow! I mean, to carry that burden would kill me. God has a plan. He is sovereign. He is the centurion of centurions. He commands the whole deal. And he decided that in this story, that was best. You gave him the information. You trusted that he was able to do what he needed to do with the information. He did what he needed to do. Now, do you trust him? Or is your faith simply in yourself? We still function like pagans so often, like the Jewish people did. Oh, if I muster up enough of this and a little bit of that and mix some of that in there, boom, I've got an equation for healing. No. These people were commended because Jesus said they bought into me. They didn't buy into what I would do, they bought into me. And because they bought into me, what I could do was a natural progression of that. Without faith, we cannot please God. Without faith, we will not see healing. Without faith, we will not see life change. I agree wholeheartedly. Faith is critical to the equation, but where we place our faith is just as critical, if not more so. Do you trust Jesus as centurion, king, lord, master? Or do you try to prove to Jesus that you believe enough so he'll do what you want? Two very different stories. And when I hear so often, I think we all have enough faith in the room to see this happen, I go, faith in what, man? If we all have enough faith, then we'll trust that whatever Jesus is about to do will be fine. And we will tell him what we want because he is our Father. And we will trust that he can do what we want because he is God. And when he doesn't, we'll go, cool. And that's faith. Watch. As though to stand in the face of two circumstances where someone came by faith and Jesus did this because of their faith, he does this. Third story, verse 14. When Jesus came into Peter's house, so this is right after he healed the centurion's. Now remember, he's healed by touching. And he's healed by saying, right? So both those are there. Later on, we'll find him healing by telling someone to wipe mud on their eyes and go and spin around and 10 times in a circle. And you go, what? And then we hear him healing because somebody brushed by his ankle. What? So there's just no standard, guys. There's no like, if these three things are in place, Jesus heals. He heals when he wants, how he wants, in any way that he wants. It's his call, his choice, his way. It doesn't really make any difference what's going on in your life. In fact, half the time he's healing people that have great faith, and half the time people are healed before they even knew he passed them by. They're like, what? Watch, here's one of them. When Jesus came into Peter's house, he saw Peter's mother-in-law laying in bed with a fever. He touched her hand, and the fever left her, and she got up and began to wait on him. Would have been cool to hang out with Jesus sometimes, you know? How you doing, sweetheart? I'm doing fine. Can you go and get me some food? I feel so much better. I know. Isn't that awesome? Fever's gone. I mean, sometimes Jesus did this stuff. And I don't read anywhere there. Peter's mother begged Jesus in faith and strength that he could. He walked in. She wasn't feeling well. He said, get away, sickness. She was fine. She waited on them. Okay. That's fun, isn't it? When evening came, many who were demon-possessed were brought to him, and he drove out the spirits with the word and healed all the sick. This was to fulfill what was spoken through the prophet Isaiah. He took up our infirmities and he carried our diseases. Why is Jesus healing the leper? Why is he healing the centurion's son? Why is he healing the people that sit in front of his house? Because they asked? No. Although because they asked, they were part of the story. So should we ask? Yes! Did he do it because they asked? No. He did it to fulfill the prophecy in Isaiah that he was the Messiah, because all Jesus is doing is declaring himself Messiah constantly. And everything he does is to declare himself Messiah so that people will buy into who he is and they will give their souls to him and they will be rescued forever in eternity. This has nothing to do with the circumstances we face. Those are given to us and they come and go differently each day, and we are called into obedience regardless of which one it is. Is it difficult to lose someone to a disease? No, it is more than difficult. It is horrible. Is it difficult to see someone in prison that is not set free after we've prayed for months, years? Yes, it is difficult. Is it difficult to bear the burden of having a disease that is eating away at you and you've prayed every day and God does not take it away? It is difficult. Is it amazing when God supernaturally does those things? Yes. Does God still do that today? Yes. Must God do that? No. Will he do it every time? No. Do I know why? No. And one of our elders here said to me, just before third service, I said, man, I'm trying to unpack faith in 30 minutes with three stories. I'm a little overwhelmed. And he says, well, good luck. I have 7 definitions for faith. That's after years of boiling them down. I'm like, exactly. It's difficult, right? But what we do know is this, that we are called to place our faith in Jesus. We are called to trust in him alone and not in ourselves. And faith is not something we muster a bunch of in our life and hand it to God as though that somehow will get him to do what he wants. Faith is something you have or you do not have. If you have it, you trust your centurion commander. What he does is okay, what he says is okay, and where he tells you to go, you go, and when he tells you to come, you come. And if we don't have faith, we play games all day long and we feel terrible when they don't work because we think it's our fault. This is America. We love our Savior. We just don't like our Lord very much. If you cannot figure out how to follow Jesus as Lord day after day, then when faith matters and you're going through the big, huge, difficult things, it will fail you because your faith was never placed in the right place. If you trust Jesus as Lord, then you will trust what his word says and you will put it into practice every day. You won't be perfect. Don't worry. That's not what we're calling you to. I mess up on a regular basis. But I'm acutely aware of it, and I run quickly to Jesus and go, oh my gosh, I'm so sorry. Can I try that again? Because I'm not silly enough to think I should not follow you. Our faith is what we do every day. And then, when we come to Jesus with big things, we can trust that he will do what is necessary to continue our story just as he has planned it to be. On this planet, we all die. Yep. At a certain point, we all face trouble. Sometimes Jesus changes it, sometimes he doesn't. You will find in this story, just in the book of Luke, right after the centurion, John the Baptist, one of Jesus' dearest friends, is in prison. He's going to get his head chopped off. And he sends a message to Jesus. I'm getting ahead of the game now. You're getting a bit of bonus material, third service. Sends a message to Jesus saying, are you really the Messiah? Because I'm still in jail. That's basically what the message was. Jesus sends a message back to John. Good luck in jail. Yes, I am. I'm not even kidding. John gets taken out of jail, gets his head chopped off while Jesus is walking around healing people. What? Jesus didn't heal everyone, folks, while he was on this planet. Only some. Didn't rescue everyone. Only some. But he did bother to have the author of Hebrews write these words. And I close with this today. And when you think that something isn't happening in your life that God ought to be doing because you don't have enough faith, you remind yourself, it's not that I don't have enough faith. I'm just placing it in the wrong place. This is what it says. Hebrews chapter 11, verse 32. And what more shall I say? The author of Hebrews writes, I do not have time to tell you about Gideon, Barak, Samson, Jephthah, David, Samuel, and the prophets, who through faith, are you listening to this? Through faith, conquered kingdoms, administered justice, gained what was promised, shut the mouths of lions, quenched the fury of the flames, escaped the edge of the sword, whose weakness was turned to strength, and who became powerful in battle and routed foreign armies. Women received back their dead, raised to life again. That's what faith is for, right? You have enough of it, and those things happen. Except for one small problem. Others were tortured and refused to be released so that they might gain a better resurrection. Some feared jeers and flogging, while still others were chained and put in prison. They were stoned. They were sawed in two. They were put to death by the sword. They went about in sheepskins and goatskins, destitute, persecuted, and mistreated. And the next line is not, if only they had enough faith, they would have been like David and Samson. The next line is, and the world was not worthy of them. They wandered in deserts and mountains and in caves and holes in the ground. These were all commended for their faith, yet none of them received what had been promised. God had planned something better for us so that only together with us they would be made perfect. When God heals you, celebrate. When God does the miraculous, celebrate. When God doesn't, know this. The world is not worthy of you as you journey through the horrors of disease and struggle and persecution, whether it comes from people or from disease or from sin, whatever it is. And we will find in the kingdom of God that those of us who have suffered most will be most highly exalted. And those of us who had the most miracles here will have the least to talk about there. Don't be so quick to think that when God does not rescue you from your trouble, that he has forgotten you or that you do not have enough faith. Instead, I dare say that maybe God has a story for you that brings you to greater faith than you can imagine. Trust in Jesus and his ways. And his calls and his decisions, regardless of whether they are what you want or not. And your faith will be rightly placed. And you will live in freedom indeed. Let's pray. God, thank you for your love for us. Remind us each day that you love us, that you are powerful and able to do all things, that there is nothing you cannot accomplish and cannot do. And that when things do not happen on this planet the way we dream them to happen, and problems are not solved and diseases are not healed and tsunamis are not stopped, that though we will never comprehend why, you are doing what you are doing. Help us to have the faith of the centurion, to understand deeply that you are Lord, that you love us, that you will always do what is best for us, and that our story matters to you. in whatever circumstances we face, life or death, disease or health, in prison or free, well-fed or hungry, that we would find our contentment in this, that you are our everything. We trust you, Jesus. We do not trust what you do, we trust who you are. So help us to look past what you do or don't do and remember who you are. We love you, Jesus. Amen.